Good morning, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. You are welcome here, no matter where you come from, no matter who you are, what you believe, or whom you love. We are a community of individuals who have joined together in a common bond of consideration for each other. We consider ideas that would further the welfare of our fellow humans, preserve our planet, and enhance world peace. We do not adhere to any particular creed or sacred book, but are bonded by the seven principles which are outlined on the back of your program. We're glad that you're here and hope that you receive a cordial reception. If you'd like to receive our newsletter, there is one available out on the back desk at the entrance, or if you sign the guest book, why, we can have a newsletter mailed to you either electronically or by mail. If you are not a member and would consider joining us at any time in the future, you could signify your understanding and commitment to the seven principles and sign the membership book. It is that easy. The formalities are very few. Following the service, we hope that you will stay for coffee and to talk and meet other members of the fellowship. On your program, I have written a line, what could be more worthwhile than remembering your own life? And just a couple of other things about that. Our senses allow us to remember the events of our lives, and we store them as electrobiochemical images in our brains, process them for meaning, and retrieve them intact or synthesize them into new ideas that would be useful for tomorrow. Sarah Manguso, a diarist, says, "We write the experiences as a way of saying that we are paying attention to our lives. Otherwise, we wake up at the end of our life realizing that we have missed it and that no one knows who we were or where we have been or how we have affected the lives of others that come after." We have varied programs, and today is one of them relating to this topic. I received no other announcements other than the ones printed in your bulletin on page 2. So take note of those things which affect you or are of interest to you. We now light the chalice. It signifies, it is a beacon that we carry in our hopes for mankind and for all the earth. There we are. Okay, we will now have the opening hymn. This land is your land. There is an insert in your program with the words, and I'm sure you know the tune. It will be led by Michael Oldfather on guitar and Dick Beeman singing. So please join us. Stand if you are inclined or not inclined.
Your land, this land is our land, from California to New York Island, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw a California to New York Island, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun came shining and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling, as the fog was lifting, a voice was chanting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. Whether ordinary or bound for glory, in city or prairie, we all have a story. Each of us is a traveler on an untrod highway. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. This land was made for you and me.
Thank you. This is a time when we are able to express our feelings about significant events in our lives, things that have happened to us or those we hold dear, and to say what concerns we have for others and for our world. So wait for the talking stick to come around. Hold up your hand, and I see Jim. Okay, we have Sarah. Yep.
Jessica Severs. I'm really excited to see a lot of new faces today, so I want to welcome everybody. Yesterday we had a wonderful I-70 concert. Michael and Kathleen and our social committee and everybody that came and helped set up or played and sang. I think it was a wonderful day, and if you weren't here, you really missed out. And I think, is it next week, is Earth Day. And I just am rejoicing in all of the beautiful flowers that are blooming, and get out and enjoy it.
Jim over here.
Jim Chanteau. Well, I have a concern. I missed the choir yesterday. I'm really sorry to have, especially since I sing in our choir. The reason I missed it is I was up in Rochester, Minnesota, this last week at Mayo. As many of you may know, I had a seizure last Thanksgiving, and that was being checked out. And the news I received from the neurologist there was very good. It was that the seizure seemed to have been a product of a healing brain, because I'd had a surgery about 5 years ago to deal with an issue. And anyway, they say that I'm very unlikely to have a repeat as long as I stay on my medications. So I will plan to stay on my medication.
Bobette McGoy, as some of you may have seen on Facebook Friday, our daughter-in-law Molly passed her master's defense. And so we're very proud of her. As are Rob and Nick, and two other people I'm sure would be very proud too. That's your mom and dad. And we wish they were here to celebrate with us. But when we got the message on, a text message on Friday afternoon that was that she had passed, Nick made a comment that I think we can all agree with. Remember what that was?
Was there ever really a doubt?
Okay, thank you, everyone. Today's also Karen's birthday, McGoy, who visits us from California from time to time, my sister-in-law. So that's another cause for celebration. And yesterday, I want to update everybody. UUFM participated in the Pride Parade, parade again. We had a good turnout. Some people joined us halfway, count it which way you want, 15 people or so, and some kids, and they had a bounce house in the Triangle Park, which was a big hit with any kids that participated. But the really good news is that it was the largest crowd that I think I've ever seen at a Pride parade before. There were tons of people in the parade and tons of people at the park showing support for the community, and so we really appreciated that. So thank you to everyone who came, and thank you to everybody who supports our efforts in that area.
Pat Embers, our daughter Sheila arrived in Portland last night with her two kitties on a two-day trip with her two kitties in the car, and they freaked out the whole time. So we're really happy because it's been a rough time for her to get up there, and we're just really happy she made it. Okay.
Well, I had a longer piece on the concert yesterday, but I want to thank all of the singers and the social committee, especially for sending our travelers home with some food in their stomachs after a long afternoon of rehearsal and performance. They just did a great job. And I was thinking about it, there's a 10-month gestation period. If you think 9 months is long, 10 months is really long. A lot of people did a lot of work.
Shirley Hobrock. Bryce and I just returned from a wonderful week in Delray Beach, where we met our grandchildren, who are 2 and 5, and our daughter and son-in-law. And our 5-year-old, we have to brag, he got Student of the Month.
Hi, for those of you that follow my son, Eric, yes, he was hit by a car. Fortunately, it was not worse. He was not run over. He was knocked off his bicycle by the passenger side mirror, so you know how close the vehicle was. Mm-hmm. He has a broken collarbone. Bones are separated, but on Friday they put a plate in, and that'll be in for 3 months. He's been slowed down a little bit. His little Julia needs to tie his shoes. But he's on the way to recovery, and we're pleased it wasn't worse.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anyone else? Okay, well, thank you for expressing all your thoughts and concerns. We will now have the story for all ages, and to be conducted by Sandy Nelson.
Can you tell I'm a little disorganized? You grab the numbers. You hold the clicker. Good morning. Ooh, it's dark. This morning, you may have paid attention, and June and Charlie Kempthorne are going to talk about writing your memoir, your family history. I'm good? And a little bit maybe about journaling. If I click the clicker, does something come up? Oh, but if I do, does it? Which button do I push? The star? The one on the left? Or the one on the right? And, you know, I need notes, and I'm sorry. So they're going to be talking about that while we're back in our classrooms, learning about and discussing the world around us and generally how it relates to the UU7 principles. Who wants to tell me what journaling is? Leah. Take a journal or a notebook and write something down that's personal. That's absolutely right. You jot down notes and take pictures, keeping track of what goes on in your lives, because truthfully, as you age, it becomes more difficult. And I rely on my children, as my children will testify all the time, to say, "What? How did that go?" And Lily will, "Mom, it went like this." Da, 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 da. We don't always agree, but what? But she says she's always right anyway, so takes after her mother. So a memoir is a story using those notes and pictures and the memories. It's a story about your life. And usually I come up here and read a story because I love stories. I think they tell us and teach us about the world around us. And but today we are going to play a game, if I can get this to work. You say that. Just hit anything, and maybe a slide will change. Press any key. See, not only is my hard drive all filled up, I just need to know which button to push. That one. So we have here the start of basically 16 stories. Now, Lily is going to hand out, and maybe some of you will get more than one, number. And I want you to, maybe we could go ahead and turn the lights on once. I mean, I don't know if you can still see those with the lights on or not. I want you guys to scout around and see if you can figure out who those people are. There's everybody up there is in the room. So take a minute to look. Okay, and now you guys out there, if you have pencils or something, use your program. See how many you get right. Now, I know there's one or two people here that know at least one or two people here up there, because probably they contributed. What do you think? Okay, go. Go see if you can find somebody. Go, see if you can find one of those people. And just hand whoever you think it is, just hand them a number. If you think that's them, hand them a number. If you think that person looks like that number, hand them a number. Try to keep the girls girls and the boys boys, but you don't have to. Where is Arthur? He's way over back there. He's next to Matt. Okay. Who's got number one? Okay, and if a child gives you a number, please stand up. Come on, you guys. Clock's ticking down. I'm going to count from 10. Hand out your numbers. 10. Just hand them out. Pick somebody. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. 5. Any educated? Come on, I don't see but one person standing with a number. 4, 3. Oh, you can stand over here if you've got a number. Lily's got a number. Okay, are all the numbers handed out? Hand them out. It's not me. Hand it out to somebody. 7 is a girl, Colby.
I know.
Okay, find a girl. I see several. Okay. We'll give a hint, all right? Would everybody who's up in these pictures, in addition to anyone who has a number, please, anybody who has a number, and anyone who's on the screen, please stand up. If you are able. Stand as you are able. Okay, now there's a hint. Take your number, look at the picture, and see if someone standing, maybe. Okay, I'm going to count this time. 10, 9, have to have them distributed by the time I get to 1. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4,
Okay, Colby is three people. Okay. Well, so did anybody get a number that is actually them? Very good. That's impressive. Now, don't worry. We'll have a reveal here in a minute. These 16 pictures represent 16 different stories. How'd we do? We got three. Who was the... Four? Who was the easiest? Arthur was the easiest. Why do you suppose... Well, Arthur looks exactly the same. Why is that? No time has passed. He is indeed that young. Who is next? Who is next easiest? Molly was pretty easy. No? Not okay. Molly didn't get her number. Who else got their number? Lily. Lily got her number. Not too much. She's number two. Not too much time has passed. Actually, that's 10, 12 years. And who else got a number? Michael Oldfather got his number. How did that happen? Random. Wow. Was there any hint going on there? Uh-huh. Six. Six was Michael Oldfather. Okay. So... The memoir is your story, and that there, that's one piece of the story. And remembering with just one piece of the story can be really, really hard. There's one piece. It becomes easier if you add pieces to your story puzzle. So maybe by adding a note or a picture here and there, or every day or every week, or every month, or even every year, well, eventually you'll have more of a complete story, a story that's your story that you can tell your family and share with others. And maybe you'll figure out who's who. Anybody figure those out? Do you want to turn the lights off or not? Please, if you're up here, please stand so we can see. You guys recognize these folks? Thank you, everyone, for participating. I'll have this in the narthex at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Hearts go with you. Knowing love.
Thank you, Sandy. That was fun. Is there a representative from Fairy Godmothers here? Oh, sure, Donna. Donna Orpelding will speak on behalf of Fairy Godmothers. This is our monthly program, and we dealt with in our offertory, and I'll mention that in just a minute.
Thank you, Bryce. Once again, it is a privilege to be here and to share information about the Fairy Godmothers. Let me begin by thanking each of you for your past generosity in supporting the Fairy Godmothers' mission. We began 9 years ago with a core group of 50 women. Our present membership exceeds more than 650 at this time. Our goal is to help women in need in the Manhattan community. And your Helping Hands ministry allows us to do that, and the funds you contributed are greatly appreciated. The money donated will go into our grants fund. A woman seeking assistance completes an application at one of our referral agencies, the Crisis Center, Salvation Army, the Emergency Shelter, the Boys and Girls Club, the Flint Hills Community Clinic, Home Care and Hospice, and Shepherd's Crossing all act as referral agencies. Once the application is completed at one of these agencies, it goes to our grants committee for review. The maximum amount that can be granted is $600, with an average grant being about $440. The money is paid directly to the vendor, and a woman may only receive one grant per year. I'd like to share with you just a few stories about grant recipients. A woman lost all her belongings because she couldn't pay for storage. She and her children moved into a supported housing, and they all shared one bed. The fairy godmothers provided a bed for each of the children. After graduating from nursing school, a woman needed her nursing license in order to find work in her field. A grant was approved to cover the cost of her license. A woman on disability and her son live in a mobile home. The son works at a fast food restaurant on minimum wage. Their furnace needed a new motor. A grant helped with the cost of the repair. A woman receiving counseling at one of our referral agencies struggles with mental illness that impacts her daily life. She fell and broke a front tooth. We were able to grant her funds to have the tooth repaired. Needed car repairs were granted to a woman who is raising her deceased sister's children. Reliable transportation allows her to get her to her job, which provides the necessities for herself and her adopted family. These are just a few stories from our 113 grants we distributed in 2014. With your financial gifts, we can continue to assist many women and often their children with timely goods and services that cannot be provided by other agencies in Manhattan. If you're interested in more about fairy godmothers, I've left some of these brochures on the table by the door. Thank you again for your concern and for your beautiful, generous spirits.
Okay, thank you, Renee. Now time for our program. By way of introduction, I want to say that, and although your program identifies me by name and at the bottom of the page, that my mentor for the last 10 years has been Charlie Kempthorne, and it had a tangible result. in that last year I was able to publish this volume, 450-page volume of my personal memoirs. It never would have happened without Charlie. I attended a class here at the fellowship beginning in 2005. Charlie encouraged me, and really he has a way of pumping you up thinking your writing's any good at all. But clearly, I mean, Charlie is one of the truly talented writers of this community, and his stuff is the best that that I read that emanates from Manhattan. But the point is, as I had said in earlier remarks, you may reach the end of your life and no one knows who you are, and there's no record of your passing here, passing by this place. Therefore, it's probably superego that leads one to produce something of this sort, but at least you feel better after it's done. Well, okay, at least somebody will know who I was. So, Charlie and June, the floor is yours.
Doy many wear the bib overalls. You're a cute little booger, have to say that. Well, I'm Charlie, and Bryce, thanks. That's being your mentor, I think, is a bit much, but I appreciate it. We did get him started, but you know, and I don't want to say too much by way of introduction. I want to get everybody started. And Jude, why don't you go ahead and hand those out? We're going to give you some paper and some work. But in 1976, bored with my job at the Adult Learning Center as a GED coach, which was a way of paying for our hog operation, I started a workshop of some older people. I had nine old ladies and one old man, Bill MacArthur. I don't know if any of you remember him. He was a school principal. And we started a reminiscence writing workshop. And it was now, many years later, I realized that was probably the first one ever anywhere in the universe. No one's said me nay on my claim that that was the case. However, the interesting thing that came out, well, the thing I want to reference to what Bryce said about getting him started writing, that came out of that workshop was a lady named Jessie Fovo, who was then only about 80. And she sat right down. Most of the people wouldn't write, and that was a lesson to me. It wasn't that they couldn't write, but that they would not write. And Jessie, however, for whatever reason, wrote. And she sat right down and wrote a couple hundred pages. She read it to us every week as we met. And some of the old ladies were pretty shocked. She had married a drunk and finally divorced him, and they were shocked not at his drunkenness but at the fact that she divorced him, because those were the days when you stayed with your guy no matter what. Well, this guy was a complete jerk, and she finally divorced him. And anyway, she wrote her story. I could go into it. It's on our website. But the bottom line is that about 20 years went by and we got it published. And she got $1 million for it in a cash advance from Warner Books, and died rich at the age of 100. After buying, she spent about $100 or so. She bought a new rocker, a new dress, and sheetrocked the basement because of all the kids coming. She had 8 children, 35 grandchildren or something. Had to have a place for them to stay. But Harry Smith, you may remember, was at that time a CBS News anchor, interviewed us, and he asked me what I did for Jessie Fovo. And I just blurted out, I didn't think. I just said, well, I gave her a pencil. And that's what we did. That's what he ran in the news thing. But that's pretty much what I did for Bryce. Just kind of, Barbara Bascom and I set up a workshop here that met every week. This was only 10 years ago or so, and we called it Eat and Write. We met at lunchtime, brought a bag lunch, and we talked and we wrote. And Bryce was more than almost anybody I've ever met, just chugged right down the track, and he's written a compendium and a wonderful memoir, which I don't know if it's available in the UU library. It ought to be. and it's a big, thick memoir. So we're going to remember Bryce. His children and grandchildren will remember him. And more than just being remembered, I think it's a matter of empowering the future. You know, you read, perhaps you have a scrap or two of memoir from your parents, and that reading that gives you some sustenance and empowerment to go forth into the world. And I, more and more, I'm thinking of it as being debriefed, to use the military term. If you go on a long and arduous mission, you come back, you're taken into a little room and debriefed, I think they call it. And they ask you how things went, what did you do? Well, we're all on a long and arduous mission. And for some of us, it's time to be debriefed before debriefication or is totally impossible, because as Fred and I were talking before, we tend to forget some things. He reassures me that we still have some memory of the aura of people, but we forget names and ultimately a lot more besides. But there's time now to write a memoir, and the encouraging thing is kids are starting to do it too. And what I'm going to ask without further much of anything, does everybody have a copy of this by now? Everybody has this sheet of paper with the drawing on it. Would you turn it over on the back? Just take a glance at it as reference. This, I guess I should tell you. Can I move out here and I'm still heard? No? Did I turn it on? Is it on now? Okay, good. Well, anyway, this is a picture of June, my wife June's farmhouse, where she grew up in near Clay Center, Kansas. And I asked her to do this, back in 97, to draw that floor plan. And then as she drew, to put in some of the memories that occurred as a result of the drawing. I ask you to do that now. Turn it over on the back, and you should have a pen or a pencil or some kind of writing instrument. If not, raise your hand. But draw the floor plan of the house that you grew up in, if you have such a house. Now, if you moved 20 times as a kid, as I did, maybe there's one house that in particular you think of as your childhood home. Draw that house. Draw the floor plan. Draw the yard outside beyond it. You can't do this wrong, believe me. Just make the drawing. Now, in the program, we had reference to the fact that this, you could write about your life in this church, or fellowship, I guess we call it. And you might want to draw the fellowship, the floor plan, say, of the old sanctuary over there, or this one, for that matter. Some of you are quite young, I notice, so everybody's quite a bit younger than I am. Anyway, go ahead and make that drawing, even as we're talking here. I'll shut up for a minute or two. Lori, do you need it? Okay. So just go at it. And the important thing, don't worry about neatness or anything like that. The important thing is to make the drawing with the rooms. And maybe you remember that Grandpa's chair was in the corner of the living room. Draw that in too. Just scribble it in. And then as you're drawing, don't draw and then write, but as you're drawing and something comes to mind, go ahead and write that in. Label it, just as June did. She said, the kitchen, and it can't, the more trivial, the better, believe me. Don't worry about saying something significant. June mentions the smell of homemade bread and cinnamon rolls coming from the kitchen. Raccoons always try to reach the legs of the brooding chicken. She drew the chicken house outside. This was a farm, obviously. Mom and Dad's room was always so cool in the summer. Just do it like that. Take 2 or 3 minutes, and if you have a problem, call me on my cell phone or something. Raise your hand. You still don't have a pen that works? Here's one. I think we brought the jar of pens that don't work anymore. We wouldn't want to throw them away, but take that one. I'm sorry. Good. Okay. I hope it works. You were number... Weren't you number 13? Up there, wasn't that you? I thought so. Good. Yeah, nice big drawing. Write it in. You don't have to hand it in. You can be sloppy as you want. June's pretty neat because she's a neat person and she's an artist by trade and training. But when I did mine, mine's really sloppy. So the whole point is to stimulate your memories of your childhood. Okay. Put in as many as you can. Go ahead now.
Siblings, I get to this.
Oh my, okay. Think of the cats, dogs, children, goldfish, snakes occasionally, perhaps, if you lived in the country as I did. Boogeymen looking in the windows at night.
Seeing all these wonderful kids come up to story hour.
Yeah, if you're drawing the church, wouldn't you do that? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'm going to launch ahead because we've got a lot of stuff to do and not a lot of time, but please feel free to go right on drawing and remembering and writing that in. But what I'm going to do is I'm now going to read something to you that I wrote many years ago, and I've used it at workshops to demonstrate the difference between summary and scene. I have to say that I'm a recovering English teacher. I taught freshman English, and we didn't teach in those days anyway very much about narrative writing at all. Everything was an essay, and the main reason for that really was the purpose of freshman English, at least sub rosa, was to get people so they could pass an essay exam. And so we taught them how to have paragraphs that had unity, coherence, and development. Well, the sad part of that story is that we taught them to hate writing for the most part. Most people who have finished, the more education they've had, the more they dislike writing and they hire it out to someone else. Now, I know there are people in the room who love writing, have written 1,000 words already this morning, but the general population, they really hate it. And so my job is to remove the reasons for those hatred, that hatred, if at all possible. So if you'll look at this sheet that June handed out to you with the text side of, well, I guess it's the blank, it's a blank page. But I'm headed at the top. It says, should you write summary or scene or something in between? You all have that so you can follow along. And I'm going to read this. Dad was born January 7th, 1903 in Platteville, Wisconsin, a twin. His mother was Minnie Louise Nodoff Kempthorne, and his father was Guy Rudolph Kempthorne, a blacksmith. Dad had 5 brothers and sisters. He was graduated from the University of Wisconsin in 1932 with a doctorate in medicine. He moved to Indianapolis, Indiana, to the University of Indiana, and where he became a resident in Iron Nose and Throat. There he met my mother, and they were married January 6th, 1934. He fathered 3 children and served in the U.S. Army Medical Corps during World War II. In 1946, he took up the practice of medicine in Manhattan, Kansas, where he remained the rest of his life. In 1978, he retired. On May 10th, 1983, he died. He is buried in the Pleasant Valley Cemetery in the Deep Creek community near Manhattan. His zip code was 66502, and that's supposed to be a laugh line. Thank you. Okay. Now, that's data, right? That's data about my father. It's all true. I'll read the next piece. The phone began ringing. We stopped eating and talking and listened for our ring. One long ring came and then another immediately following. "Charlie, you answer that," Mom said. Everyone started eating again as I ran to the phone. Mom knew I loved to be helpful. I was back in a minute. "Dad," I said, "it's a patient, I think." Dad went to the kitchen where the phone hung on the wall, picked up the earpiece and spoke into the phone. "Hello, this is Dr. Kempthorne." He paused. "Uh-huh," he said, and then right away again. "Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh." We resumed eating and smiled at one another. "Uh-huh, uh-huh," we heard Dad say each time after a brief pause. I started giggling. "Charlie," my mother said in a sharp whisper. "Uh-huh," my brother said, and my giggle turned into a laugh. Mom frowned and shook her finger at Kerman. "Oh, uh-huh," we heard Dad saying. "Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, wash it out." He paused and then shouted, "I said wash it out." And then he went on saying, "uh-huh," three or four more times. And then he hung up. When he came back to the table, he picked up his knife and fork, laughed, and shook his head. "Ear problem," he said. "Oh, uh-huh," my brother and I said together. And Dad looked up suddenly with the chunk of roast beef already in his mouth. He laughed merrily, covering his mouth with a napkin, being careful not to choke. Well, okay, certainly wouldn't want to choke a throat specialist. Can't you see the headline? Throat specialist dies from choking. Wouldn't look good at all. I ask at the bottom, I hope by now sort of rhetorically, which of these two passages conveys the most information? And what is information? The kind of information that we want about our parents or grandparents or whatever. And which is better history? I don't really have an answer for that, but over the 30 years or so that I've been doing this, I've come to question what is history anyway, you know. I actually had a major in history. I didn't declare it, but I had 30 hours or so, and I loved it. And I love it still. But, you know, when they wrote about us in the history books, at least back in the 60s when I was in college, we were the last paragraph of every chapter. And we were the hoi polloi, or the masses. And we were always in a turmoil. We wanted more bread or whatever. No one was mentioned by name, of course. There wasn't room. Nor was even had there been room, they wouldn't have mentioned us by name. And that suggests, by the way, something about church history. Now, there's a beautiful and graceful church history that I produced, but Bryce... I used to get you two guys mixed up all the time. Brock Dale, thank you, who was a mentor to all of us, really, and a founding member, I think, of this church, wrote a wonderful history in 1997 about this church. And it's gracefully, and Brock was a very intelligent, graceful writer. It's wonderful. And there are quite a few mentions of ordinary people, but... There really is no church history of everyone who was ever here. I mean, some are regarded as unimportant. And I, as a leveler and a 60s hippie, ex-revolutionary, perhaps I'm still a leveler, and I think that everybody is perhaps of equal importance in some way. And so June and I have done a couple of workshops at Unitarian fellowships or churches. We did the Church of T.S. Eliot in St. Louis not too long ago. We're trying to get everybody to write something of their own history, to contribute to the church history. Well, anyway, so I've come to believe that everybody should write their history. And if we had, I also believe, or come to believe, that if we had the history of everybody, if we'd had that from the beginning of time, we might have a very different world today. I mean, do we learn from history? That's what they told us in history classes, you know. And so anyway, but that's just an aside. What I hope we have now is you've finished your drawing, and I would like you to write something, and I'm going to give you about 8 minutes to write it. I would like you to write a scene from your life, either here or your childhood, girlhood, boyhood, whatever. You don't have to finish it. It doesn't have to be a story. It doesn't have to be funny or sad or even on the surface meaningful. Just write a few lines of narrative scene It seems to me the fundamental unit of human history is the narrative scene. And if you just write something like, Uncle George was very fond of chicken gravy, one day the children ate it all before the bowl got to him and he was very angry. I just made that up. Can you tell? Anyway, if you just write something like that, don't write about it. Show, you know, it's like show and tell. Show what you, if you can. And just do it. Now, there is one way to do this wrong, and I don't know that I borrow this a moment. This is bad writing. Okay, that's bad writing. Everything else is good. Okay, thanks. And I'll shut up for 8 minutes. That's hard. I just asked June if she was ready to read. She said, no. I've got to get a volunteer here, though, the guy with the bib overalls over here who became dean of the library. He was the picture. I don't know what number it
14.
Was. For number 14. Would you read, please?
I hope I don't interfere with your thoughts, but I wrote the following. We returned too early. 8 dead cats lay scattered at the base of the wind charger on the southeast corner of the house. Dad had been complaining, too many cats. Born cats, multiply like rabbits. Isla, fix some extra pancakes. These cats will eat anything if you smear it with a little bacon grease. My aunts were often called into duty to come and take us away to avoid unpleasant incidents, and had taken us away that morning. Something was going to happen. We didn't know what, but we returned too early. Our aunts doted on us. They were both maiden school teachers, always unmarried, hated men, except for my dad and my brother and I. But today, they returned too early.
Okay, thank you. Good. Okay, thank you, Bryce. And we want to have a volunteer. All right,
okay,
Mike.
Do you want to stand
Mike.
There, or?
Yeah. Wherever you're in charge.
What do you want me to do? All right. All right. I thought of this when I drew the plan for the house that we lived in from the time I was 10 until 25. So grade school, last grade school, junior high school, and college, and a little more. I don't have anything to wear, my sister sobbed on the other side of the wall where Dad and I were finishing our breakfasts. Have you tried this blouse and skirt? My mother patiently asked. I think it would be a cute outfit. No, whined Anne. Marlene has both pieces and she wears them all the time. Dad and I dressed in our regular clothes, him for work, me for school, and my best jeans and shirt and socks that matched. I was a clothes horse even then. Just looked at each other. We didn't say a word. We were glad that we were men and not involved in Mom and Ann's daily ritual.
Okay, great. That's history.
Okay.
Yeah, get Dick in here.
I was about 10 years old and looked out the front door of our house that afternoon and saw 1, 2, 10 monarch butterflies fluttering around the front yard. By evening, the little birch tree in the middle of the front yard, a mere 15 feet from the front door, was dripping and sagging under the weight of thousands of roosting monarchs. Since then, I've seen photos and videos of tens of millions or hundreds of millions of monarchs at their overwintering site in Mexico, but nothing could match the wonder of those few thousand right outside my front door.
Great, good. Okay, Pat, please.
As a child, we sat as a big family around my grandpa and grandma Vanatta's kitchen table, big oval farm table at their house, at their farm. We were eating farm food from their garden, their chickens, grandma's mashed potatoes and gravy. The highlight of the meal was always when Grandpa would lift his knife flat side up in the air and ask the grandchildren, "You want me to eat my peas with my knife?"
All right. Yeah.
The kids all stopped eating, eyes glued to Grandpa, who was looking at us all with a big smile. Grandma, meanwhile, was declaring, "Oh, Dad." None of us kids heard what she said. We couldn't wait till he picked up his peas. So gingerly and gracefully, with the flat side of his knife, hold them in the air so they wouldn't drop, and eventually slide them into his mouth. A huge cheer from the kids ensued, with laughter from all the parents and Grandma standing there with a smile of surrender. And Grandpa was beaming as the star of the show, with all grandchildren in total approval and ecstasy.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Hey, Jennifer.
Wait.
Let's get Jennifer, and then we'll get Jean.
This is such a cool exercise. I love drawing the house.
Okay.
And this was written thinking about the house on North Waco Street in Wichita, where I lived about age 2 to about age 8 off and on, moving back and forth to Lawrence and Kansas City. But it was a 1915 or so bungalow. The morning bungalow was always empty except the sunlight. I was wide awake by 5 a.m. while the rest slept like sandbags in a heap. About 9 a.m., my older brother, Tom, big dark eyes and a rug of black hair, would tumble to life. He'd join me on the dining room floor, a well-scuffed wood surface that was our play zone. He'd marvel at my toddler creations and puff up my sense of self as a mini artist genius creating in colored wooden blocks. Often our parents would snooze till early afternoons on the weekend, sleeping off the work week and Friday night beer-soaked gatherings at the Center for People's Culture. Sound familiar at all? That left Tom and I to forage for ourselves at ages 2 and 4, and we did, hopping through the front yard to our kindly German neighbors, an older couple who always, by coincidence, were cleaning out the fridge and invited us to smorgasbord on bread and grape jelly, leftover ham, or scrambled eggs.
All right. Beautiful. Great. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I'd written to Uncle Jim and Aunt Martha for them to bring me one of their kittens, and that I wanted a white one. Easter morning, they arrived from Louisiana, and they brought two kittens, one for John and Charles, and one for me. I was holding my white kitten, and our dog captain bounded through the porch screen door, ripping it and lunged at me. I dropped Snowball, the kitten I'd had for about 3 minutes. Captain, the wire-haired terrier, took Snowball and ran out. The circle of children and adults were stunned, and I felt horrible from the terror, but also because I had not protected Snowball. I was about 5, maybe 6. Many years later, Mom shared with me that she'd gotten a rabbit as a child Easter morning. Going out after Easter lunch, she found that the slipknot her uncle had made had choked the animal to death. I realized in the past few years that those 3 minutes were a sacred space. My brother's cat, Henry, was immediately put out as an outside cat. I knew then that I would have never gotten to have Snowball as an indoor cat like the cat of my friend Jenny.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah. Someone over here, how about... I'm sorry, go ahead, yeah. Normally, we try to do these workshops with 12 or 15 people so that everybody can read, because that's part of the learning experience, is that you can write, sit down and write something and read it, and people will enjoy it, and it will take them into your life. Okay, Gene.
On an 8,000-acre cattle ranch, Skeeter was a birthday surprise, an early morning object to trip over in the hallway of the barn as my dad was going out to do the chores. The surprise breeding was a result of his favorite quarter horse mare, Dimples, had been bred to a Shetland stud without anybody knowing. 1.5 years later, my dad's challenge to me, his 7-year-old hired hand without a horse, was for us to break or train each other. At my small size, it was okay for me to start riding him a little earlier than normal for both of our training. After nights and nights of me kicking and kicking while dad was doing chores and probably laughing, with no result other than more kicking and Skeeter not going anywhere, it was a major success for me to actually get him to go someplace. But he progressed rapidly in his training, and in no time we were galloping around. And he learned very well the task of stopping, planting all fours, and usually with the terrain in the corral area being somewhat slippery, would come to a skidding spot, stop. One night I didn't figure it was worth taking the time to put a saddle on him, so I figured it was time for our first bareback ride. We quickly left the corral and headed out to the small pasture south of the house. As I pulled on the reins and yelled, "Whoa," he did his part. Me, without a saddle horn to hang on to, flew over his head. Somehow, I managed to grab an ear in both hands. And so in about 1.5 seconds, my head was bouncing on the ground, looking at his nostrils, as his head was bobbing up and down, trying to decide what to do. I didn't really know. He wasn't going to wait on me for a solution to the problem, so he snorted, threw his head up, I flew back on his back, and we rode off. To his credit, I have to admit, he was a better cow horse than I was a cowboy. Just a few years later at a local showdeo, in the horsemanship where it was 60-40 weighted on the rider, we got second. When it was 60-40 weighted on the horse, we got first.
Thank you, Gene. Now, Jim, and then we have one or two more. And let me do Jim, and then I don't know your name, but you're next. Okay. Jim, you need a mic, don't you? Yeah.
There you go. This is a story from when I was 5 years old growing up in California. At least it starts. As the nectarine juice dribbled down my chin, I wandered from the backyard through the gate around the side of our house. With only the nectarine seed left in my mouth, I dropped it on the ground by the gate next to the walkway and stepped on it, putting it into the dirt. The next year, a small tree sprouted. I remember shielding it from my rambunctious brothers, who would knock everything over. By the following year, there was a small tree growing. It was noticeable. 3 years later, it produced its first nectarine. By the time we had moved, it was a tree large enough to shade us, producing an abundance of nectarines every year. We ate them greedily. From thereafter, my nickname in my family was Jimmy Nectarine Seed. I'll never know how many people enjoyed the yummy nectarines from that tree, but I still step on a fruit tree seed here in Kansas whenever I finish a peach, apricot, plum, or nectarine. Perhaps even in Kansas is possible for a fruit tree to grow.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Okay, thank you. What's your name? Sarah?
Okay. Yeah, Sarah Hoyt. The reason I wanted to share this is because I've had a rough week with my foster daughter. It's because I've had a rough week with my foster daughter, who's 4. She's putting everything in her mouth and needs to experience her world, you know, through touch.
Read what you have.
So when I thought about my home, it was all about what I felt, and I didn't realize I would have been the same way. So the kitchen counters were a light pair of pale gold, hard and cool. Sitting on them was a rare treat. It meant being with Mom, who spent most of her time there. It meant that my sibling, I can't do it, sorry. I just wanted to say.
Maybe Larry would read it for you. Is it? Thank you.
Yeah. The kitchen counters were a light pale gold, hard and cool. Sitting on them meant being with Mom, who spent most of her time there. It meant that Laura, Stephen, and Lindsay weren't there competing for a family's worth of space on the formica, and it meant something to eat. Maybe a raspberry from the garden. Maybe a frozen grape or a piece of cheese, but most likely a spoonful of chocolate chip cookie dough, gritty with salt and sugar, raw and sweet.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, well, we're 1 minute away. I'm sorry we have to stop. You know, Michael Nelson, when he wrote to me, Reverend Nelson, and asked me if I would do this, if we would do this program, he said, be sure to do something, show something, read something of your own or something that really gives some kind of oomph or power to the whole thing. And I didn't want to read anything of my own. I'm sick of my own stuff. But this is a thing, and it won't take long to read Pat Foster. Now, that Pat Foster, some of you may remember, was her father. I'm sorry. Again, I go back to Brock Dale. Brock Dale's son-in-law is Pat Foster, and his daughter is Maggie. Some of you knew Maggie. I have a picture of her here with a baby, a couple of her children. I'm going to read this. Her husband wrote this. It's called What a Night, and Pat lives in Spokane. The night of January 31st, Maggie's water broke about 11 p.m. I woke up about an hour later having brushed up against something wet. It was the towel she had put under her. I thought, well, here we go. This is it. Butterflies in my stomach now while I write this as then. Her contractions weren't very intense, were short and 15 minutes apart. After 45 minutes, she got up and vomited. This was starting to get very real. She became serious, so I called the hospital and described what was going on. The nurse said, if the contractions got any longer, come on in. With Maggie's change in mood, I figured we'd better go. So we grabbed a few things and headed into the snowy night. Betty and Brock, Maggie's parents, were here, so we didn't have to worry about Anna Lee. By now, it was about 1:15 Tuesday morning. As we got to the car, Maggie felt a strong urge to urinate, so she dropped her sweats to squat in the snow. But a cold wind was blowing, and she changed her mind. We got into the car and drove toward the hospital. She was doing her low moans during contractions, which were now one on top of the other. Her heavy breathing steamed up the car windows, and it was snowing hard. I was wondering if we were going to make it to the hospital as I crouched down to look through a clear spot in the windshield, straining to see through the snow. After a few minutes, each low moan crescendoed into a wail. She shouted that she wanted drugs. Transition. We're not going to make it. What the hell do I do now? Keep driving. Almost to the bridge, Maggie yells, I have to push. Oh, Jesus. Pull over. Get out. Open her door till the seat. Tilt the seat back. Get the damn boots off. Get the pants off. There's a head halfway out of her. Oh, look at the blood. I hope to God that's normal. The head is out. Push. I have to wait for a contraction. She groans. With another contraction, he slushes out into my hands. Oh, God, I hope he's okay. So much blood, slippery and warm. Put him on her stomach. Maggie gets the cord off his neck. Put my jacket on him. Snow is cold on my back. He's breathing, sort of gurgling. Need help. Close the door, go to the nearest building, an apartment house, knocking on doors. I need help. Call 911, please. No response. Back to the car. Maggie's okay. Baby's breathing. Get back in. Cross the bridge and stop at the first gas station. Baby's breathing okay. Color's okay. Maggie's color is okay. Call 911. My wife just had a baby in the car. Wow, really? Congratulations. Sheesh. I'm transferred to a fire station. I tell them where we are. Back to the car. They're on their way. Turn the car around so Maggie's side is in the light. Maggie and baby look okay. She has her bare feet on the dashboard, legs apart. A guy walks by on his way into the food mart, apparently thinks we're having sex under the lights of an all-night food mart at 1:30 a.m., and he gives us a thumbs up. Maggie gives him one back, grinning. He grins and keeps going. The car's nice and warm. Maggie and baby still look okay. Where are they? Sirens, four guys on the fire truck, two paramedics in the ambulance. They sure are calm. Ask me how mom and baby are doing. They put a space blanket on baby to keep him warm, close the door. After a long time, they've decided on how to proceed.
Maggie gets out, holding the baby with the cord still on, standing barefoot in the snow, nothing on from the waist down. I'm so proud of her I could bust. She lays on the gurney, talking with the crew, into the ambulance. They all go to the hospital, burst through the emergency entrance, paramedics and firemen in full regalia, wheeling her right up to the maternity, up to maternity in room 910, all of them. It's crowded and smells of smoke from the fire crew's gear. Congratulations from all around. I sign some papers and they leave. What a great bunch of guys. It's quiet. The nurse takes the baby to the nursery. Maggie delivers the placenta. Okay. I go to the nursery and see our son. His temp is 96 something, too low, but he'll be okay. Back to the room, tell Maggie she's fine. Back to the nursery, he's fine. Call Brock and Betty at about 2. Hang around for 2 more hours. Baby's temp is up. He goes in to meet Mom in a little while. I get sleepy as the adrenaline fades, so I head for home to sleep so I can be there when Anna Lee wakes up. Oh, what a night. Isn't that great?
Okay, thank you very much. I wish all of you could read. By the way, if you'd like to put your name and your email on the sheet of paper and drop it up here with June, we would love to publish it either in Life Story, which comes out PDF every week, or online if you would like to do that. But be sure to put your name and your email address on there, please. Thank you very much.
And also, if you would like to get the email once a week, it comes PDF and it's free. Email me or give me a piece of paper with your email on it, and I'll see that you get it once a week.
Okay. Thank you, June and Charlie. What a great amount of talent we have in this group. We really appreciate hearing from all of you. So we have no closing hymn. We are adjourned. Thanks for coming.